From Pacifica Radio, this is Democracy Now! It's Labor Day. We'll talk to John Sweeney, president of the AFL-CIO, about the state of labor under the Bush administration. And we'll go to Canada, where tens of thousands of workers are taking to the streets in Toronto. And, as usual, live from Durban, South Africa, during this UN World Conference Against Racism, we'll talk to members of South Africa's largest trade union and the Los Angeles Bus Riders Union. All that and more coming up on Democracy Now! Welcome to Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. Four bombs exploded in Jerusalem today, slightly injuring five people and overshadowing efforts to arrange talks between Israeli Foreign Minister Shimon Peres and Palestinian President Yasser Arafat. Despite the explosions, Peres said in a radio interview he might meet Arafat on the sidelines of a three-day business conference near the Italian city of Milan on Friday in efforts to arrange a ceasefire after nearly a year of violence. European Union Foreign Policy Chief Javier Solana was due to meet Israeli Prime Minister Ariel Sharon and Arafat separately to try to pave the way for the truce talks. The Popular Front for the Liberation of Palestine claimed responsibility for the blasts a week after Israel assassinated its leader in a missile strike. In related news, Israeli and U.S. officials warned today they might walk out of the United Nations Conference Against Racism, saying that diplomatic efforts aimed at eliminating criticism of Israel from conference documents seem to be failing. The remarks by the U.S. and Israeli officials came after a coalition of rights groups meeting separately presented a report that attacked Israel as, quote, an apartheid regime that had committed, quote, racist crimes against humanity, including ethnic cleansing and acts of genocide in its treatment of Palestinians. Meanwhile, in the West Bank, Israeli helicopter gunships today destroyed a Palestinian security services position in Dura at the west entrance of Hebron. And this news from South Africa. Diplomats resumed their search today for a deal to prevent a UN racism conference being derailed by sharp divisions over Middle East violence and reparations for the slave trade. The UN meeting entered its fourth day, seeking a way to win over the U.S. delegation, which has objected strongly to a draft declaration that criticizes Israel. Demands by African states for an outright apology and for reparations by former slave trading countries for 400 years of human trafficking have been also resisted by Washington and European states, which fear a rash of possible litigation. UN Secretary General Kofi Annan, who left the South African port city of Durban on Saturday, has warned the whole event could fail unless these disputes are resolved. North Korea unexpectedly shifted its stance toward South Korea yesterday by announcing it would immediately resume stalled talks with Seoul. Relations between the two Koreas thawed last year, and a historic summit between South Korean President Kim Dae-jung and North Korean leader Kim Jong-il in Pyongyang on June 15, 2000, raised high hopes for reconciliation after half a century of enmity since the 1950-53 Korean War. The South Korean president won the Nobel Peace Prize for his efforts to bridge the long divide with Pyongyang, but things have since ground to a standstill. Kim Jong-il has held back on a promised return visit to South Korea due to his anger at Washington. This spring, the Bush administration bluntly told South Korea was not interested in supporting talks between North and South during a visit to Washington by Kim Dae-jung. The United States will brief China on its plans to test a new missile defense system in an effort to win Beijing's acceptance. This, according to a White House spokesperson, U.S. officials will share information on their missile defense plans with the Chinese as part of an outreach effort in preparation for President Bush's trip to Beijing next month, according to a spokesperson for the National Security Council. The spokesperson at the same time denied a report in the New York Times that said the administration is also planning to drop its objections to China building up its small nuclear arsenal in a bid to get Beijing's support for U.S. missile defense. Arms analysts estimate China has about two dozen nuclear missiles capable of reaching the U.S. The spokesperson also denied reports in both newspapers that said as part of the new effort, the United States and China might also discuss resuming underground nuclear tests to ensure the reliability of their arsenals. in proposing a missile defense system. Bush has cited the threat from countries like Iraq and Iran and is eager to deploy a shield, including missiles launched from ships and lasers fired from modified Boeing 747 aircraft. But the plans would violate the 1972 anti-ballistic missile treaty and have been firmly resisted by China, Russia, and many European allies who fear a renewed arms race. And members of Minnesota's largest state employees union this weekend authorized a strike that could affect universities, parks, and prisons across the state. A union negotiating team last month rejected the state's offer of a modest pay increase and recommended its 19,000 members walk off the job. The union has asked for a larger annual raise and increased insurance. Results announced Saturday showed union members voted 90% in favor of the strike, which could begin September 17th. Governor Jesse Ventura has stood behind the state's offer, saying employees should be happy in a climate of corporate layoffs. And a U.S. consumer group and a labor union today made a Labor Day appeal to the government to protect workers' health by lowering the permissible exposure to beryllium, a metal linked to a fatal lung disease. Beryllium is commonly used in the manufacture of sporting goods, dental equipment, and airplane parts. Workers can inhale beryllium fumes or dust during manufacturing, and exposure can lead to chronic beryllium disease, a lung condition with symptoms of weakness, fatigue, and respiratory or heart failure. Consumer group Public Citizen and the paper Allied Industrial Chemical and Energy Workers International Union petitioned the government to lower the permissible exposure limit to beryllium from the standard set in 1949.
Job, please come to the crossroads. You can save the children I know.
My Blood, Neville Brothers, Yellow Moon, here on Democracy Now! Resistance Radio. I'm Amy Goodman as we go live to Durban, South Africa, in what's believed to be the biggest protest since the end of white rule in 1994. Close to 2 million South African workers last week participated in a two-day general strike against the privatization of public services. The strike, called by the Congress of South African Trade Unions, or COSATU, has shaken the ruling so-called tripartite alliance between the dominant African National Congress, the South African Communist Party, and COSATU. Tensions between the three mounted after the ANC took power with the first multiracial democratic elections in 1994. According to critics, the ANC gave way too much to multinational corporations in an attempt to lure international investors. Now some say the ANC has sold out and is just towing the neoliberal line. Today on Labor Day, we're joined by COSATU's chief education officer, as well as Los Angeles Bus Riders Union member Eric Mann, who is in Durban for the conference and marched with the COSATU workers last week. Joining us in the studios in Durban, South Africa, is Malengi Bengu, COSATU's chief education officer. Welcome to Democracy Now!
Thank you very much.
It's very good to have you with us. Can you talk about the protest of last Friday? And I'd also ask if the engineer could take out the mic of Eric Mann so that we can really hear Malengi Bengu for the beginning of this conversation. Tell us about this two-day strike and why you chose to do it exactly the time of the World Conference Against Racism taking place in Durban.
Well, what is important to spell out from the onset is that COSATU, for a very long time, alongside other working-class formations in South Africa, have been engaging government in other elements of the state regarding the best way in which we need to build the capacity of the state. And obviously it would be argued that one of the best ways of doing so is to manage properly the assets that are owned by the state, which is what the strike was about. And these discussions have been taking place for a very long time, actually for years, about a framework within which the restructuring of the state-owned enterprises as part and parcel of the democratization and the deracialization of South African society have to be managed. So it wasn't just a once-off decision to hold the strike during the proceedings of the World Conference Against Racism. There are key issues around which government and labor have not found one another. And we don't see this as simply just an economic strike. It is also about defending the rights of the South African majority who struggled for many years so that they have access to water, electricity, food and bread in their stomachs. It's not just about narrow shop floor questions. Well, of course, we would do that as trade unions, but this time around, it is a strike around which we want to mobilize the entirety of South African society and the other global forces so that we intensify struggles against privatization wherever it takes place, not only in South Africa.
Now, the government of South Africa beseeched COSATU not to have this strike at the time of the conference. It just finished up before the conference began. Why did COSATU stand firm on the date?
Well, I think that, obviously our view is the Federation supported and mandated by the 2 million members that we have, as well as the broader support base that COSATU enjoys in South African society, had to stand firm. Had to stand firm because we know that even though we have achieved formal political democracy since 1994, and I mark my words when I use the word formal political democracy, it simply means that without transforming the economy, building a strong developmental and democratic state, without that, that formal political democracy remains hollow. So we've got to intensify that struggle. We've struggled for an ANC-led government. We will continue to support it, but we will defend workers and the entire working class whenever we think that their interests are being undermined. And we certainly think that government's policy on the on privatization, which they call restructuring of state-owned enterprises, rolls back a number of struggles that workers of this country have led.
We're talking to Malengi Bengu, Chief Education Officer for COSATU, the Congress of South African Trade Unions, live in Durban, South Africa, where the UN World Conference Against Racism is taking place. Malengi Bengu, COSATU has, though, agreed to limited privatization in the past. Can you talk about that, as has the South African Communist Party?
Yes, I think, firstly, you know, it's very important to explain the point. And the point is really that there are aspects of what is known as state-owned enterprises or public enterprises, as we could normally call them in South Africa, that would include organizations or companies such as Transnet, which is responsible for rail and transport, Spornet, which is responsible for rail, Portnet, responsible for harbors, Eskom, responsible for electricity, and Telkom, responsible for telecommunications. These are just examples of very huge state-owned enterprises that command a lot of capital that could be best used to support development. Now, we also have other state-owned enterprises such as Aventura, which is responsible for tourism, holidays, etc., etc., managing holidays, holiday resorts, etc. Now, obviously, COSATU's fixation is really with the kinds of state-owned enterprises which provide the services that are really basic for human survival and for sustainable livelihood, and the kinds of state-owned enterprises that will contribute to ensuring that we deliver water to people, clean water, we deliver sanitation, we deliver food, and we think those are very basic. We deliver electricity to a majority of rural people that have never had access to electricity for a very long time. And we're saying that those kinds of enterprises, under no circumstances should they be privatized, because once they're privatized, the interests of private enterprises is different from the interests of what should be the interests of an emerging national democratic state, which is what we are still fighting for. We haven't achieved that as yet. That's different from Aventura, which may have auxiliary services that it manages. And we think that in the interest of managing state-owned enterprises, restructuring is in order. Restructuring is in order because the apartheid state had no interest in providing services and basic services to people, and certainly to the black majority. Now that we are having to expand the mandate of these state-owned enterprises so that they are able to cater from the historically oppressed black majority, there is a need for some form of restructuring so that they are efficient and they are able to work effectively. Now, that is really where we are. We're not hung up on an ideological conception of privatization, which is usually interpreted to mean that everything must never be thrown to the private sector. The private sector can handle administration of some of those holiday resorts, in our view. But we think that you cannot hand over management of the delivery of electricity to the majority of South Africans. So, and I think that those two services, tourism and water delivery or water supply, are qualitatively different from the point of view of a country that has been ravaged by the scourge of poverty and inequality. For a majority of us, a tourist facility is very luxurious, and we think that we need to start there. We can have a discussion later on down the line about how we manage our tourism. Obviously, we know it's an important income generator. And obviously, I'm just picking up on one example. So we're not supporting privatization, but we're saying that what is known as non-core assets could be privatized, could be commercialized, and you should look at a menu of options and not only confine ourselves to this classical privatization as it has been seen elsewhere. So that is really where we stand. And we're saying that with water, electricity, the telecom, for instance, installation of telephones, those should not be left to the private sector, because the private sector in South Africa and globally has proved that they're not interested in making a dent or contributing to a fight against poverty and inequality. And so we've been very consistent on that line. In fact, we mobilized workers to vote for the ANC on the basis of basic service delivery that is going to be driven and led by the state. That is strong, that continues to build its capacity so that it is able to deliver efficient services to our people.
Malengi Bengu, what role does the World Bank and the IMF play in these issues of privatization?
Well, as you would know, South Africa is increasingly assuming some center stage within the global community, but more particularly within the financial institutions that you've just referred to. And we're saying that the policies that we have committed ourselves politically through the manifestos when we go and vote as South Africans and as a new government are largely inconsistent with the policies that we support within the WTO, within the IMF, and within the World Bank. And we're calling on our government to actually use its own influence within those structures to challenge what is taking place there. We know, for instance, that the privatization is largely shaped and influenced by the neoliberal framework that South Africa, as a component of the UN system and a number of these financial institutions, has not been able to challenge in the manner in which we would like to see that happening. But we know that, in fact, we can't just make calls. We've got to mobilize our workers, our members. We've got to mobilize workers in general and other social formations in South Africa so that, in fact, we build a strong mass movement in this country that is able to consistently engage our own government and support our government where we think they are taking on a progressive path that not only benefits South Africa but benefits a majority of the world's working people.
Malengi Bengu of COSATU, the Congress of South African Trade Unions in Durban, South Africa. I'm going to put off our break for a few minutes, warn our stations around the country, because we're also joined by Eric Mann, who is sitting next to Malengi Bengu in Durban, South Africa, at the UN World Conference Against Racism. He's a member of the planning committee of the Los Angeles Bus Riders Union and director of the Labor Community Strategy Center in Durban for the conference, spent 10 years as United Auto Workers Assembly line worker in the United States. Eric Mann, you were part of the COSATU march. I read one of your commentaries online that you put out, the COSATU general strike and the treachery of the international marketplace. Can you talk about the connections you see between what's going on in South Africa and what you see in Los Angeles?
Well, first of all, on a very positive note, the Ninth Circuit of the Western courts ruled yesterday to uphold the Bus Riders Union civil rights case against the Los Angeles MTA, which is a tremendous victory for the civil rights movement in the United States against the Scalia courts and so forth. So that's just a very fortunate development as I'm in Durban. But marching with the workers in COSATU, one of the things I was thinking about a lot is the tremendous pressure that they're under and how the debate gets framed. Should Mbeki do this and should COSATU do this? And the United States is outside the debate when, in fact, the United States' hands are all over this World Conference Against Racism. The United States, in my opinion, subverted the NGO conference, and it's in the process of subverting the UN conference. And one of the things I was thinking about is that if we developed, and I mean this seriously, a demand for reparations in the United States and dealt with the transatlantic slave trade, it would delegitimize the United States government at a time, and it would take pressure off the South African government so that they could have a genuine self-determination. Because to ask what Mbeki should do inside the IMF and the World Bank assumes that South Africa is the equal of the United States in these international arenas. When the United States threatens to withdraw capital, when the United States threatens to withdraw loans, when Mercedes threatens that if you go on strike, we're going to pull the capital out of South Africa, I think that people in the United States should be focusing more on the U.S. government's policies than engaging in internal debates about what the South African working class should do. And the last thing I just want to say is it was pretty incredible to march with 40 or 50,000 workers in South Africa teaching us Zulu chants, teaching us dance steps, and seeing the way that the working class is received in this country, seeing posters that say national liberation and socialism. And if I could add, one of the great things at the City Hall of Durban is several of the COSATU members said, look, we don't have socialism now, but how can we move towards socialism if we give away the state assets? It's not just a question of what's the best way to run it. The black working class has taken power in South Africa at least a little bit. And one of the things it has is state assets. So I think what was exciting to me when you discuss the AFL-CIO in the United States by contrast, I'm very sad about the narrowness of U.S. labor politics and very deeply moved by the broadness of COSATU's politics in South Africa.
Eric Mann, we're going to be going to John Sweeney in just 1 minute, who, in fact, is in Los Angeles today and then headed up to Northern California. But in terms of your own struggle, the L.A. Bus Riders Union, can you talk about what's happening there as it relates to issues of privatization?
Yeah. In fact, when I was here, it even helped me understand our own issue better because, as, for instance, the issue in Los Angeles quickly is that the state, instead of privatizing itself, has essentially become a vehicle for private capital. So what's happened in Los Angeles is the MTA has moved $3 billion in money to boondoggle rail projects to go out to the white suburbs and has bled the inner city bus system for 400,000 overwhelmingly minority bus riders. And I thought about it and I realized that this is a different form of privatization. Rather than taking capital outside the state, it's using state capital to help construction companies, rail companies, black and Latino bourgeois contractors. Essentially, it's diverting the surplus away from the working class towards the privileged classes in the United States. It's a very classic, in some ways, IMF development model, a structural adjustment. And I think in marching with the COSATU workers, I realized we have to use those expressions better in L.A. We've said fight transit racism, but I think we also have to say fight structural adjustment, fight the seizure of state assets, as COSATU is saying. And the other thing I want to say is that we have to really get our dance steps better, you know, because we're pretty good in L.A., but I think I learned a lot of stuff here that I want to bring back about a kind of vibrant mass movement that we've built. So I think what's exciting about COSATU is that I think people in communities of color inside the United States, whether it be New York, Chicago, Detroit, Atlanta, should start using more explicit third world terminology, not rhetorically, but analytically, to explain that our cities really are third world cities inside a first world country.
Well, Eric Mann, member of the planning committee of the LA Bus Riders Union in Durban for the UN World Conference Against Racism, joining with COSATU, the Congress of South African Trade Unions, and Malengi Bengu, chief education officer, this past week in the two-day general strike that was held in South Africa, in Durban. I want to thank you both for being with us. Tomorrow on Democracy Now!, as we continue our coverage in Durban, we will be talking with people at the conference around the issue of reparations for slavery and colonialism. And we'll be talking about the situation of India's Dalit, or untouchable caste, with three Dalits from India. You're listening to Democracy Now! Next up on this Labor Day special, we'll speak with the president of the AFL-CIO, John Sweeney. Stay with us. You're listening to Democracy Now!, the exception to the rulers. Today is Labor Day, and we're joined by the president of the AFL-CIO, John Sweeney, who's now in Los Angeles. Welcome to Democracy Now!
Thank you.
Can you talk about your plans for Labor Day?
Yes, well, I intend to do a number of things here in Los Angeles, starting off with a religious service with Cardinal Mahoney and many labor leaders and activists. They're expecting 2,000 people from different unions wearing their uniforms and bringing their tools and other distinctive identifications with the jobs they do. And then we're going to do a rally and going to focus on some of the issues such as stopping Fast Track Trade Authority, and then on to a couple of other of labor-related events, and off to Oakland and San Francisco for some events there as well today and tomorrow.
Mm-hmm. On Tuesday, you're beginning a campaign a tour, is that right, with union presidents. Can you talk about that?
Sure. We're doing a bus tour around Northern California, meeting in local unions and at work sites with workers to explain to them how important the issue of trade is and how important it is for us to lobby our members of Congress against Fast Track until it includes core labor standards and environmental protections.
Explain what you mean by Fast Track.
That's to a move to give the president the authority to negotiate a trade agreement without having to get the approval of Congress. And we think that if he's going to have that authority, there has to be a requirement that core labor standards be a part of our trade agreement in both our countries, our trading partner, as well as our own.
Mm-hmm. Right now, we're talking about a national labor picture where 13.5% of all workers, 9% of the private sector are unionized. These are not very high figures. How are you going to unionize more workers in the United States?
Well, these numbers are, it's not the numbers that have declined, it's that the workforce has increased and we haven't kept up the pace of organizing new workers in new jobs as well as traditional jobs. We have been, over the past few years, more aggressively organizing and training new organizers for the long term, and I think we're reversing that trend very slowly, but I think that you're going to see a steady increase in union membership. There's an Associated Press poll out, I guess it's out yesterday, showing that the perceptions of unions is on the increase. And we think that with a number of the issues that workers are concerned about, such as the layoffs that are occurring in our country, that there is going to be more interest in joining unions, realizing that they can't resolve their problems by themselves.
There's a debate going on within the AFL-CIO how much money to put into electoral politics versus organizing. Where do you stand on this issue, especially in light of the big defeat of Al Gore, which the AFL poured millions into his election?
Well, when we endorsed Al Gore, we knew that our members supported him, and the turnout from union households in the election was the highest probably that it's ever been in terms of union membership supporting a particular candidate. Unfortunately, we didn't have enough, and we have to continue to activate our membership at the grassroots level on the political issues, not just for national, but for state and local government as well. And we've been doing that. We've had a real active program over the past 6 years since I was elected, and it's shown by the increased number of union members who are voting and who are registering to vote. But in terms of what our priorities are, it is important that we be involved politically. Our members want us to be involved, and some of our members are Republicans and many are Democrats, but they all agree that the labor movement has to be out there electing people to office who support the working family agenda. But just as important, we have to build a stronger labor movement, and organizing has to be our top priority as well. And I think that we have the ability to do a good job at both. I think we're seeing more organizing activity going on with individual unions than we've ever seen, and we just have to do more organizing in order that we have more members to be active politically.
We're talking to John Sweeney, president of the AFL-CIO, on this Labor Day. The president's immigration policy, he's going to be taking it on increasingly. What is your assessment of where the administration is going when it comes to immigration and their what looks like going to be a very strong push for guest worker programs?
We're not sure exactly where the administration is going on this issue. We know that it's going to be discussed between our president and the president of Mexico later this week. We are for full legalization of immigrants, and we think that immigrant workers should not be discriminated against and should be entitled to the same laws and the same benefits that other workers are, and so that's why we support amnesty. We're going to lobby in Congress for this, and I think that the president has had to slow down on whatever he's going to propose because he doesn't have the support in Congress. Guest worker, expanding the guest worker program just doesn't work. It just makes the problem worse in terms of how these people are exploited and how they're discriminated against. And
Can you explain what guest workers are for those who are not familiar with it and what specifically the problems are?
Guest workers would be allowed to come and work for a set period of time. Some of this work would be in jobs that are seasonal, such as farm workers, but it could be in other industries as well. And it is just using these people to fill some temporary criteria, but not giving them the benefits of that other workers have. And we think that it's discriminating against these people. We think that the president of Mexico wants to treat workers in an equitable and fair way, and we hope that the administration will support that.
A study has just come out on the issue of drilling in the Arctic Wildlife Refuge, where it's been put out by Dean Baker, co-director of the Center for Economic and Policy Research, which says that what the Teamsters have endorsed and what's been promised if there's drilling in the Arctic, 750,000 jobs, is a tremendous overestimate, and it's something like 5% of that. What is your take on this with the Teamsters' big endorsement of drilling in the Arctic and the split this means for Teamsters versus environmentalists?
Well, I haven't seen the study yet, but I will be looking at it to see what we can learn from it. Individual unions take positions based upon how their members feel, and much of it is based upon their industry and their jobs. And I believe that the Teamsters are environmentally responsible and do want to protect the environment. But it's not just the Teamsters. There are other unions who feel the same way. And since we are a federation, I'm trying to balance the differences between different unions on this issue. And you'll be hearing more from us over the course of the next couple of months.
Now, the Service Employees International Union that you come from and the United Auto Workers have spoken out against the drilling. So how are you going to come up with a balance?
You'll have to wait and see.
What about military spending? President Bush, a big push to increase military spending, and specifically Star Wars. Will the AFL-CIO be taking a stand on whether military spending actually creates jobs?
We will be monitoring the administration's proposals on defense spending, and we will be watching to see if we think that they're attempting to appropriate more money than is necessary for defense. We are also watching closely to see what effect this has on programs, on other programs that are important to workers and to their families. And there's a wide range of issues, education and health care. We've been going through this debate all throughout the budget process, and now we're learning about the wipeout of the surplus and the effect that that might have on Social Security. So it really requires looking at the whole picture.
AFL-CIO has come out with a statement encouraging people to come out to the World Bank IMF protests. I wanted to get your take on Genoa, the protests there, what they meant. The young man who was killed, Carlo Giuliani, I understand he was the son of a union organizer. What the AFL's plans are exactly for the end of September in Washington?
We plan to be active in peaceful protests that will be taking place in Washington. We speak out strongly against any of the terrorist activities, as well as sometimes the reaction of of police authorities, but if you look back to Seattle, when the WTL met in Seattle, there were, I guess, somewhere around 40,000 people and a handful of troublemakers who caused some of the damage that was done and so on. Basically, at all these events, 99% of those who are participating are peaceful protests and protesters, and they have they have a right to assemble and they have a right to express themselves. The Genoa situation was unfortunate. I'm not sure just exactly why or what went wrong there. It is unfortunate when anyone is hurt or killed in a situation like that, and the labor movement doesn't want to be a part of anything like that. But we think that people who want to form a coalition and come together, and in most of these recent situations, it's been a combination of trade unionists and students and environmentalists and people of faith and civil rights leaders all coming together in a peaceful way to express themselves. It is about time that the IMF and the World Bank are held accountable for issues that have been raised as a result of the expansion of globalization, and that more attention be paid to the developing world, to debt relief and so many other areas. And so we're going to be a part of it all.
Mm-hmm. We're talking to AFL President John Sweeney. The World Conference Against Racism, that's taking place in Durban, South Africa. The same day it opened, there was a massive march organized by COSATU, the Congress of South African Trade Unions, as they protest against privatization. Can you talk about the connection between the labor struggles in South Africa and the United States?
I think the connection is that that workers are concerned about whether globalization is working for working people, and whether it's the IMF and the World Bank or it's conferences such as taking place in Africa, there has to be more attention paid to the issues of workers. I mean, here in our own country, we saw in a very successful economic period, the workers really didn't get their fair share of the increased productivity and the success of that economy. I mean, wages only increased modestly, and that was in the later years of the successful economic period. Trade issues, I mean, no matter what major area of all our global economic issues are, the issues of workers have to be taken into consideration, and workers have to be at the table when these discussions are taking place.
Mr. Sweeney, in January of 2000, members of the Longshore Workers Union in Charleston, South Carolina, were peacefully picketing the use of non-union dock labor to unload a freighter. 600 state and local police in riot gear moved in on them. Union members were beaten up. Police, according to eyewitnesses, initiated the clash, and a riot ensued. 8 union members were charged. 5 are now going to trial for assault. You've gotten personally involved in this case. You've marched with them on the picket line. Can you talk about it?
Well, here are 5 workers who were involved in a labor dispute, and who are receiving some of the most horrible legal actions and personal hardships that we've seen in our country recently as a result of a labor dispute. These folks were arrested and were put in chains. They're about to go on trial, and the Attorney General in the state is proceeding ahead, the likes of which we have not seen in recent years. This is the United States of America, and human beings shouldn't be treated that way.
Well, I want to thank you very much for joining us on this Labor Day. If people want to get in touch with the AFL-CIO, where can they go on the web?
They can go to aflcio.com.org.
John Sweeney, president of the AFL-CIO, today on Labor Day, speaking to us from Los Angeles. Stay with us.
I don't want your millions, mister. I can't use no diamond ring. I want the right just to live, mister. Give me back my job again. I don't want your Rolls Royce. I can use your pleasure yacht. I want some food for these children. Give me back my job again.
Give me back my job, Carl Perkins, here on Democracy Now in Exile. Yes, today's Labor Day. In the early years of this country, Labor Day was an occasion for demonstrations against low pay and harsh working conditions. The Knights of Labor had their first Labor Day parade in New York in 1882. 2 years later, they formally designated the first Monday in September as Labor Day. In 1894, Congress made it a legal federal holiday. This weekend, a new study found that workers in this country are working nearly 50 hours a week, more than a century after workers fought and died for the right to an 8-hour day. Well, we're going to go north right now to Canada. 30 to 40,000 workers and their families will march in Toronto today for the 130th Labor Day Parade, which is a day of public celebration for all workers. Around a third of the workforce is unionized in Canada, compared to only, less than 15% in the United States. Among them in Canada will be thousands of Canadian Union of Public Employee members. CUPE is the largest union in Canada, with some 500,000 employees, 180,000 members in Ontario. It's a public sector union that covers municipalities, universities, schools, and hospitals. The Canadian labor movement looks extremely strong compared to the United States, but leaders say that the Canadian labor movement has a lot of work to do, especially under the new conservative government of Prime Minister Jean Chrétien. CUPE members say, in fact, it's time for the Canadian labor movement to adopt some of the policies of the AFL-CIO and go out and organize new workers. We're joined now by Sid Ryan, who is General Vice President for the Canadian Union of Public Employees. Welcome to Democracy Now.
Good morning.
It's great to have you with us. It's not great sound since you're on a cell phone, but I think it's worth it because you're out there just about to begin the parade. Is that right?
That's true. We're in the middle here of about 35,000 workers who are celebrating Labor Day. Beautiful sunny morning here in Toronto.
Well, this day in Ontario, in Toronto, is considered one of the most political labor days you've ever had. Can you talk about how you've organized it and why it is so significant?
Well, we've been battling a conservative government now for the past 6 or 7 years in Ontario. And we've had our days of protest. We've had cities that we've closed down, created a degree of economic disruption to get a message across to the government that people are very upset with their policies. We've moved into a new phase where we're 2 years away from an election, and now we're trying to politicize our membership, getting them to understand that they cannot afford another 4 years of this conservative government. So we're on the cusp right now of a massive mobilization where we're having meetings with our membership right across the province. And a lot of people are calling for a one-day strike. But, of course, a one-day strike cannot happen unless you do the work with your membership and make sure they understand the issues and make sure they understand
it's down there.
The goal at the end of the day. So,
yeah.
So anyway, that's what we're doing right now. And this parade today in many ways kicks off that campaign. In fact, as I'm speaking to you right now, I'm with a contingent of university workers who've been on the front lines in Seattle and
David,
in Quebec City.
Can you carry this for like 10 minutes?
They're wearing, symbolically, they're wearing gas masks and paraphernalia that...
Una, we hear you as Sid is speaking.
So it depicts the
I will take it. I just,
you know, the fight that we're in with government, not just government corporations.
Una.
Hello.
Hi. Can you not speak as Sid Ryan is speaking because you're speaking over him? It's okay. Go ahead, Sid Ryan.
Okay. So what we're doing is trying to educate the membership around globalization and how that is coming to roost here in Ontario. Many of the policies of this particular government, like tomorrow, for example, we'll see the beginning of a 60-hour work week for those workers that don't have unions. Now, it's not mandatory, but what you'll do is when you go in to get a new job, you'll be asked to sign a document to see if you're prepared to work 60 hours a week. I mean, this hasn't happened since 1865 in this province, and it's a sort of an indicator of how we're being pushed down to the lowest common denominator on many fronts with respect to labor legislation. So we know it's imperative now that the only thing that stands between a decent standard of living and decent working conditions for workers, whether you belong to a union or not, is the labor movement. And we have to change our tactics a little bit and respond to the challenge.
Sid Ryan is General Vice President for the Canadian Union of Public Employees. And in the midst of him, you heard Una Padgham, who is also a Canadian Union of Public Employees member and a spokesperson for the Committee for a General Strike. The leadership of CUPE is publicly espousing bringing social issues to the bargaining table. Almost 50,000 union members marched in Quebec City to say that globalization is a local issue and that union members do care about its effects. Protesters today, or those engaging in the Labor Day March, are wearing gas masks and bandanas as a symbolic gesture to highlight the fight against corporate globalization, hoping to call for a general strike of all workers across the province to highlight the anti-union policies of the Prime Minister, as well as the push toward corporatizing and a growing anti-union sentiment. Una Padgham, you're one of the spokespeople for this group. Who are you marching with today in Toronto?
I'm marching with a lot of CUPE members who are out here who are saying that the time has come to make the connection between what's happening in the global economy with the liberalization of trade, with fiscal conservatism, and how it's affecting our jobs and our lives, and everything about the existence of working people and their allies.
What do you do in Toronto?
I work at a university. I'm a staff person, and I'm here with teaching assistants and contract faculty. We have city workers here. We have people who work in the schools as janitorial and support staff. We have people on drums, as maybe you can hear. I'm going to move away from them. CUPE represents a wide selection of union members who do a lot of different kinds of work.
Let me ask Sid Ryan how group of people that Una Padgham is with now, as they push to bring in issues of globalization, how that affects the overall membership of the Canadian Union of Public Employees, this whole issue of bringing social issues to the bargaining table.
Well, actually, I'm with the same group that Una is with, just a little bit off to her right. I see her on there in the cell phone. Actually, I would say that the university sector in Ontario right now are possibly the most mobilized sector that we've got. We represent people in municipalities, in school boards, in hospitals, nursing homes, and, of course, in universities. I'd say these are the most mobilized. They're more connected to the issues, I think, than most folks are. they've gone through, the university sector have gone through some very high-profile strikes in the recent past, and their sector is energized as a result of that. They've taken on the university sector, they've taken on the administration, and also, by extension, they've taken on the Ontario government, which are driving a policy inside of the university sector of raising tuition fees. And what CHUPE is doing is trying to connect that question of tuition fees to the bargaining table, which presents a victory for all people in the province, not just for those unionized workers who won it. We actually managed to force the university to rebate to the student associations, or at least to the teaching assistants and the research assistants, rebates on their tuition. So we've connected their tuition fees to the bargaining table, which is the first time we managed to do that. By extension, we've also helped ordinary average working class families in Ontario be able to send their children into have a post-secondary education. So in that regard, I think the university sector probably gets it more so than the other sectors do at this moment in time. But we're using the energy of these young people to drive the agenda inside of CHUPE, drive CHUPE to a more militant, more left of center position, which is it's actually beginning to work. People are buying into it.
Una Padgham, in Canada, a third of the workers are unionized. In the United States, we're talking something like 13.5%. How does what goes on here in the United States affect you in Canada?
Sorry, I missed the last part of your question. How does
what's happening here in the United States affect you as workers in Canada?
Well, I think that we're seeing that the policies of the American government, as well as other governments around the world, are having a direct impact on workers in Canada. But we see it all over the place. It's in the United States. It's in Australia. We're seeing the privatization of social services. The free trade agreement of the Americas certainly puts pressure on Canada's social services, which has a drastic impact on the public employment sector in Canada, and which has a drastic impact on our ability to deliver quality Medicare, quality education, quality social assistance. These are all things that working people have fought for in Canada for a long time. And there's been huge changes in the past 10 years. We've seen the privatization of water. We're seeing the privatization of our medical services, the privatization of social services. The impact is huge. And we live in a world where the decisions of governments and of trade organizations like the WTO, like the FTAA, they have a very real impact on the everyday lives of working people. And union members here in Canada are saying, enough, we want some say in what's going on. Not only that, we want to connect to working people, the unemployed, the poor, and other places around the world, and say, we need a say in what's going on.
Well, Una Padgham and Sid Ryan, I want to thank you very much for joining us from the Canadian Union of Public Employees, speaking to us from Toronto, where between 30 and 40,000 people are marching on this Labor Day. And that does it for today's program. You can mail us at mail@democracynow.org. That's mail@democracynow.org. Democracy Now in Exile is produced by Chris Abrams and Brad Simpson. Anthony Sloan, our music maestro and engineer. Errol Maitland of WBIX.org, our spiritual and technical advisor. Special thanks to Miranda Kennedy. And thank you to Pacifica stations, especially KPFA and Roy at KPFK. And of course, our affiliate stations around the country. We are Pacifica. We're broadcasting from DCTV in the historic firehouse of Engine 31. In the midst of a firestorm, what better place to be? In exile from the embattled studios of WBAI, the studios of the Band and the Fire, the studios of our listeners. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for listening.